Blog Talk Radio.
Where there is fire, there is smoke. And in that smoke, from this day forward, my people will crouch and conspire and plot and plan for the inevitable day of man's downfall, the day when he finally and self-destructively turns his weapons against his own kind, the day of the writing in the sky, when your cities lie buried under radioactive rubble, when the sea is a dead sea and the land is a wasteland, out of which I will lead my people from their captivity, and we shall build our own cities in which there will be no place for humans except to serve our ends. And we shall found our own armies, our own religion, our own dynasty. And that day is upon you now!
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane.
No, it's Max, Darryl, and Debert, your host for the Comic Shop Show.
Yes, y'all. I never get tired of that applause. That Roddy McDowell diatribe, Roddy McDowell soliloquy, was quite incredible. It still holds up. You know, he has surely missed a great thespian, again, from the Planet of the Apes first franchise, one of the first great sci-fi franchises, the first Planet of the Apes, not the Tim Burton debacle. Welcome, folks. Welcome to the Comic Shop. This is Double Mint Sunday. Double your pleasure, double your fun. The call-in number is 646-915-9620. Again, 646-915-9620. We have a lot to get into. Normally, I would take a quick funk break, but because of time constraints, let's just get into the discussion, into the discourse. First up, we got to get the captain, the first in our crew, to come aboard. Captain, you're sorely needed. Let's get to it.
That was my optic blast right there. Optic blast coming in. Boom.
And then, of course, we have the grandiose, argumentative, playfully, Darryl B. Now, why don't I have, you know what, hold on, folks. I have to have, for him, I have to have his intro correct. You have his intro, Captain? No? Okay, there we go. Right on time.
There's no truth to the rumor that I cloned Paul Ryan from Mitt Romney's hair follicles.
Oh, Jesus. That is a hairy crew, isn't it? That may be for that's teen hair. That would be for an Afro Nerd Radio discussion. By the way, folks, Afro Nerd Radio airs at 7 p.m. after this broadcast. We're going to be interviewing for part two. Part two, author and journalist Norman Kelly discussing his book, HNIC, Head Negro in Charge Syndrome. So that's going to be another fiery discussion coming up at 7 p.m. But now, of course, we're at the Comic Shop. Darryl.
Yeah, but like I said, hey, anybody who's ever seen Futurama and anytime they do politics, you know where my reference was coming from with that one. Send us the Republican phone.
We've got a lot to get into this evening. First up, we're just going to go through some of the blog entries, blog postings from Darryl's piece. Definitely go to Darryl's blog piece at afronerd.com. Check it out. Leave your comments. A lot to unpack from his writings. Joe Kubert, great cartoonist. One of the greats. You know, you're talking about that, you know, whether it's Stan Lee or Bob Kane or Bill Finger, Joe Simon. You're talking about that crew. Joe Kubert would definitely be amongst that crew, that higher echelon of original artists, original writers, original artists. He cannot be denied. Joe Kubert School of Cartoon and Graphic Art over in Dover, New Jersey, a staple. One of the, I think, the only accredited school devoted entirely to cartooning. So he must be acknowledged. There would not be a Sergeant Rock or a Hawkman without Joe Kubert. And he also has sons in the business, Andy and Adam Kubert. So he is sorely missed. I believe he died a week ago today, the 12th. What are your thoughts on Kubert, Daryl?
The scary thing is when we lost Mobius earlier and you had the Comics Alliance put up a piece where they had both him and Kubert just doing their art thing while it's being videotaped and you're seeing the passion and the work. And I remember I left something cryptically like, okay, we lost Mobius, you know, and this one's going to hurt, you know. At least we still have Joe, and a couple of months later we lose Joe too, you know. Hey, I won't lie. The Kubert has been part of my family for generations because my grandfather, my father, they have Sergeant Rock comics. They have the early Warlord comics. They have the Hawk World comics, you know. Me, I grew up with their sons. With Adam doing Wolverine and Andy doing X-Men and following them and going on to Batman and stuff. Hell, my sister and my mom actually have romance comics that Joe Kubert actually had a hand in. And chances are, if you're a comic book fan, you have read something that has been done, but that has had an influence by Joe Kubert, because there are so many people that came out of that school that work in the top four, top five publishing houses in terms of comic books. And you know, the legacy and the impact on the business, you know, we tend to look at Bill Finger and Bob Kane and Stan Lee and Steve Ditko and all of them, but really, when you look at the lasting legacy of the comic book profession, Joe Kubert, he left a stamp on it, you know. And sure, there's students of his that we don't like, but there's no denying that he's pollinated just about the whole comics medium. And for that, you know, you have to be eternally grateful, because that tree has long branches. And now his students are affecting more students, you know, and that's to be appreciated. Back to you, sir.
You know, there's a couple of things, too, I was thinking about that. You know, even the Joe Kubert School, I should say the Kubert School, was a staple in many comic books. It's something that, you know, especially in the 70s, I would see that ad for his school in the back of these comic books. And you start to realize so many years later just how much of a institution and how much of a staple that was. And I did not know. I did not know until actually this broadcast, when doing some of the research on Mr. Kubert, that particular school is the only one of its kind specifically for cartooning. So I thought that within itself is pretty interesting. And then, you know, also his age in the sense, I mean, he passed on at 85, but when he started, I mean, he was born in 26. And we know the comic book idiom, as far as superheroes especially, really came to being around 37, 38, 39. And he was only around 12 or 13 years of age, and he was working at that age as a cartoonist, which was kind of, I mean, you know, it's kind of amazing to hear these stories, how people got into the business. He was getting paid approximately $5 a page to draw for comic books in around 1938, 39, when he was only 12 or 13 years of age. And he said that at that time, $5, you know, this is around, you know, this is talking about the Depression time, or thereafter, I should say. He said $5 for a page for a kid was pretty good money. In today's money, I don't know how much that would be, but it was pretty expensive. So he was very fortunate to experience that. But and he also reminded that this is very much a Jewish idiom. You know, he was of Jewish descent by way of Poland. And I think there should be more of a concentration on that. I mean, I think it depends on the artist. We spoke about this a few weeks ago when we interviewed the gentleman for the Superman biography. And you know, some embraced their Judaism. Others did not necessarily want to put that in the art. But his story is very similar to all the other ones, but he's pretty young. I mean, the other ones are in their early 20s. He was a preteen working. I don't know if you'll see that in this day and age. How many kids do you see drawing their own comic books? Isn't that rare?
Outside of the brother team that does Axe Cop, there isn't many, like, people under the age of 20 in the business right now. And the guys that do Axe Cop, they're young. They're like 17 and 5, 17 and 6, you know, where the kid comes up with weird ideas and the older teen brother draws them, and it's become a success. But outside of that, you know, we often said that comics have lost the generation here, and, you know, are we going to get another Joe Kubert out of the next 5, 6, 7, out of the next decade? I don't know. I don't know, because the passion, you have to have a passion to follow it for so long and to set up your own school and all of that. And you're not getting it out of this new age. I'm sorry.
Well, you have to admit, though, that the opportunities appear to be greater. Now, when you think about someone like Mark Miller, who is garnering movie deals, I mean, these people are garnering movie deals. There's a lot more legality attached. I mean, these guys had to suffer. This wave of older artists, of, dare I say, golden age artists, they suffered or put in the due diligence in order for the artists, you know, the Gary Franks and all these people and the writers to garner these deals. I mean, now, you know, it's a whole different shtick with an artist today. And they have actually, you know, it's more of a cross, I don't use the term cross-pollinating, but they've actually have arrived. I mean, when you had these early comic book conventions, Daryl, in the 70s and early 80s, and this was such a close-knit group as far as people, you know, you and I would know who Kubert was. Now, you know, these other artists and writers are greater known to the public at large. I mean, don't you think that has an element in it as well?
Yeah, and you used the correct word there. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but suffer. Think about it. This new group of artists and stuff, they may complain, but they haven't suffered. The early artists, they actually suffered. You know, there's something to that. I forget the philosopher that said it. You don't truly know pain, or you don't truly know how to recognize pain unless you go through pain. How many artists today could survive going through what the Kuberts did, going through what Ditko did, with going through what Kirby did? You know, it's hard, and through all of that work and through all of that patience and tolerance, they earned quite a bit of wisdom. And you see the next crop of artists doing that with the next up and comers? I don't think so.
Any thoughts on this, Captain? I mean, you may not be familiar with Kubert himself, but how about this crew of old-time artists that are slowly dying off?
Everybody's familiar with Kubert. Now, here's the issue. Here's the situation. See, it could be just coincidence that the serial killer called Time is hunting down these great creators, these great artistic individuals. This could be coincidence. But Time catches up with everybody. And this is something that I mentioned before on this show. When you have these great creators, these great artistic individuals, who picks up the baton? But you see, we're dealing with this particular individual. He created the school. So there is something to be passed on regardless. This is very important. This is very important when you're dealing with comic books. Very important. And this is something that we talk about on this show here. The passing of the baton. The passing of the baton. Just as Daryl said, you have to be passionate. But just setting up a school is a way to influence and also pass on knowledge and also for you to develop your skill. So it can be like a virus. This is a cancer, infects the body. something to pass on. And then the next person does the same thing over and over and over again. Yes, of course, I do agree with the great Daryl B. that you have to be passionate. But the school says a lot. It says a lot. And we need more of that. That's what we need. That's what we need in everything. Not just in comic books, in everything. That same type of setup over and over and over again. And that's how you pass the baton. That's how you pass on the knowledge. And that's how you keep things going on and on. The older person with the knowledge, now it's passed over to the younger person. That's the way we want to do things. That's the modus operandi. It's a beautiful thing. The passing, yes, is messed up. You know, time gets to everybody. And it seems like time was relaxing for a while. Now it says, now it's time to hunt down everybody within the last 2 years. Just coincidental. It just seems to work that way. Back over to you, Sir Afro.
Yeah, I want to do a quick musical break, gentlemen. When we get back, I want to talk about this deal with Diesel or Greg for the Vision for Avengers 2. We got to talk about that. You know, I had a thought. Oh, yeah, Larry Tye, just to the audience. Larry Tye was the gentleman that we interviewed a few weeks ago that did a bio on Superman. Definitely a fascinating book. Definitely I would suggest picking it up. Larry Tye on Superman. I believe it's the Enduring, America's Enduring Hero. Let's get into a quick comic book, comic musical break, comic-related musical break. This is Adam Warrock. This is... you know what? I was trying to find something like something by Sergeant Rock, but I can't find it. All right, Infinity Gems by Adam Warrock. We'll be back in a few moments. Let's groove.
Shit! I just figured out exactly what the track's missing. Hold up.
Really, I don't understand the science of it. Ultimate nullifier, the way the mic is covered. Call me Mr. Fantastic when I spit scripture, cause every line you read, I get richer. Herald of Galactus, I spit barrel chests, lyrics for practice, tilt the world's axis. I know you're thinking it's strange that I'm a Dr. Rock like Ben Grimm, Bullseye, who shot ya? Right between the eyes and the forehead, third eye vision. Hand in hand with every word I'm spitting. Watch as I assemble rhymes coming straight at your temple. I'm like a summer-filled studio temple. I gotta be the only MC with a law degree. Those hating on my style are all Matt Murdock. See, I got the power, man, hour after hour, and stop with all the talk of Marvel versus DC. And all these cats shocking my swag, I stand up and show how green you get when you're Martian Manhunter. Yeah, I'm big-headed like I'm Bruce the Cold, because I rock around the clock and never lose the flow. And did I mention that the sense of my chest ain't for Clark? Can I spit Shaq Fu? Rickety Rock to pay the rent. Check my bank statement, rank better than state schools. A stretched out basement like the way that Bruce Wayne do. I hope the godless man, you don't want it. Throwing up a fist, cause Adam's the grand bondage. I got the soul gem making you dance as I hold the universe in the palm of my hand. And War Rock got cats ready to jump and shout. Throw up a fist if you think that you're down, because I rock it thoroughly from beginning to end. I'm way beyond ice now. I rock Infinity Gem. Mental organism designed only for killing this mic. That's a line from Tribe One on the Silver Age. And if you haven't heard a single, you ain't doing it right. Fuck that, y'all listen out like for real, man. Raised in Memphis 10 with a pad and a pen. I wrote rhymes sort of last when you heard about my MO. You never heard a cataract the way I do about the things that you love. That's why I'm here to push the envelope. Y'all wanna dance, then go ahead and dance. Y'all wanna show that I can do that for you. Y'all wanna think that my songs will make you cry and laugh. Y'all wanna wild out, I got you covered too. Like the way that Tony Dungy do, Solomon Grundy rude. I speak so sick like I'm coming out the sewers to spew. And every hater's getting toe tagged and polybagged. Long boxing, coffin, closing lids on you. So sick of the ennui all up in the comic scene. Culture that we love, so you better treat it true. I choose to annotate life, it's too scary. Call me David like my brother who's a Mary. Up against Goliath, aim for the ISI clocks. Ruby quartz, horn rims, kryptonite, high top. And why not? Maybe celebrate the way that we do. Cause even geeks wanna have fun too. I hope the godless man, you don't want it. Throwing up a fist, cause Adam's the grand bondage. I got the soul gem making you dance as I hold the universe in the palm of my hand. And War Rock got cats ready to jump and shout. Throw up a fist if you think that you're down. Because I rock it through a lead from beginning to end. I'm way beyond like that. I rock Infinity Gem. The War for Infinity. In stores now.
right. Once again, that was Adam Warrock, Infinity Gems, Infinity Gems. Folks, you're listening to The Comic Shop. It's presented by Aphna Radio. The call-in number is 646-915-9620. Excuse me, 646-915-9620. You know, during the last segment when we were talking about the late, great Joe Kubert, I was also thinking about the irony of how popular comic books are right now. I mean, at this moment in time, we are literally at the pinnacle of success and popularity for an idiom that was, for the most part, so to the left, so segregated, so much about just purely for geeks, and now the entire world. I was looking at some of the numbers, the box office numbers on some of these comic book creations. You know, I somewhat forgot about The Amazing Spider-Man. Even though I saw it, I didn't really know about the box office takedown. Spider-Man garnered almost $700 million worldwide, quietly. Batman is about to eclipse a billion. I think it's around $900 million. So to think that these creators, who really were not given their just due financially, especially the Bob Kanes of the world and the Bill Fingers, who created Batman, and now it's a billion-dollar enterprise, it's kind of amazing stuff. It's quite sad when you really get into the passing of these older greats. Anyway, enough of me waxing on that. Let's get into more pulp discussion. You know, I was looking at comicbookmovie.com, great website for our audience, comicbookmovie.com, along, of course, with afronerd.com, folks. Daryl B's entries up there right now. And they were talking about Clark Gregg, who's the actor who not only does double duty, not only is he in Avengers and all the other previous Marvel iterations, Thor, Iron Man 1, Captain America, he was in all these things. But was he in Captain America? No, I know he's in Thor and in Iron Man. Anyway, he also does the voice of Agent Coulson on Ultimate Spider-Man. So he's making the rounds, but we're led to believe, the audience has been led to believe, that he died in this past Avengers, this latest Avengers. Now, I think ever since he did die, there's been this discussion of him perhaps being reincarnated as the Vision. Now, the Vision is an android to our listening audience, an android or a synthesoid, who's part of Avengers lore dating back to when, Daryl? What, Avengers 57?
Yeah. Way back in the beginning, first creation of Ultron. Pain in the neck in the beginning, like most of the Avengers were, but you know what? A valued member of the team.
Well, there's talk about him. You know, if they had Agent Coulson come back as this android or some kind of brain patterns, I mean, they're going to figure out some kind of way. I don't see that being plausible. But if you go to comicbookmovie.com, there is a bust of Clark Gregg, a.k.a. Agent Coulson, as the Vision. Looks pretty interesting. It looks eerie. But, you know, I don't know. What are your thoughts on this, Daryl? Do you think this is going to come to fruition, or this is just, you know, wishful thinking?
Well, there's so many ways. That's just it. This is what the public doesn't understand. As comic book fans, we have been trained to figure out so many ways to bring a beloved character back. No, he isn't dead, even though we saw the body. This is how we could bring him back. It was a life model decoy. No. We could put his patterns into a synthesoid. No. See, well, that's normal for us. We always have to think of a way to bring our favorite character back, all right? And Whedon is a self-professed comic book geek. He doesn't fake the funk like other creators, Christopher Nolan. You know, so he will use comic book tropes regularly. So will he bring him back? Who knows? How will he bring him back? Who knows? But part of the fun that we have here is guessing and speculating and wondering how can we pull this off without it seeming hokey. One thing, though, if we're going to introduce him as a synthesoid, as the Vision, then that might give away part of what's going to be an Ant-Man, because you're going to have, if you're going to have a synthesoid, you got to have Ultron somewhere down here. You know, somewhere along the line, Ultron's got to be introduced somehow. You know, I'm sure they could write around it, but, you know, Marvel diehards will go crazy if we get Vision and no Ultron. But then again, you know, Superman tried to do a movie with Brainiac without having Brainiac, so anything is possible with Hollywood.
Yeah, that's what makes, you know, not to get so insider, because, you know, sometimes we have to explain this stuff to our audience who may not be as well versed as we are talking about this stuff. But that's been mentioned in print as well about if there's going to be a Vision character. Again, to the listening audience, the synthesoid, the Vision, is part of deeply embedded in Avengers mythology. If they bring this robot slash android slash synthesoid to the screen, will we see him in a Ant-Man film first? Because I'm assuming Ant-Man is going to come out before Avengers 2. Is that is that also a possibility?
Oh yeah. I wouldn't even say it's just a possibility. It's a definite. Because Edgar Wright. See, here's the thing. All right, and this is what DC hasn't gotten through their heads. DC can talk and talk and talk about we're going to put this up, we're going to put this up, we're going to put this up. But you never really hear about creators that are attached to the project. You know, Ant-Man, you got Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright all up and ready to do this. They're doing their Twitters. They're putting it out. You know, with Guardians of the Galaxy, the Marvel has jumped on it right away and talking and actively talking. Marvel's being very transparent with all of this, okay? And it's helped. Some people to criticize it, but at the same time, Marvel has a plan. They're like the Cylons in the new Battlestar Galactica. They have a plan. Marvel, and so far Marvel's plan has had very few hiccups. You know, hey, we're going to get the Ant-Man movie. Hey, we're going to get Thor 3. Hey, we're going to get Captain America 2. Hey, we're going to get Iron Man 3 as soon as Robert Downey's ankle heals. Anyway, but they have a plan. That's the whole thing. We'd be more tolerant to DC if we knew if DC had a plan for their universes. Because, like I said, yo, I'm an Avengers fan. But if DC got their act together, they got the more recognizable superheroes to the uninformed public. You know, This is why we can geek out over talking about the Vision, and you're about to bring up the Vin Diesel thing, and we could speculate, because we know Marvel, essentially with Marvel, the sky is the limit.
Well, you know what?
They're driving us nuts.
Well, let's bring the captain into this, because I think I might have mentioned this to the captain before we went on air. Captain, what are your thoughts about bringing the Vision to life? And what do you think will be Marvel's game plan as far as his look? You know, his whole thing is that he's supposed to be as close to human as possible, but he's got to look kind of freaky looking also. I mean, you know, will it work with a CGI influence, or will it work with somebody in heavy makeup? What do you think they're going to go with this?
Well,
if they go with it at all.
It all depends how long they plan on having him on the screen. If we get the Ant-Man movie, you know, you have to understand when you're dealing with the Ant-Man situation, they've slated Avengers for 2015. Fine. Marvel's universe, they're very good at building themes and building everything up from that standpoint. But also now with that, based on the storyline, you have to get into, you know, the original Human Torch, you have to get into Wonder Man, you have to get into all those type of things if you're dealing with it straight from the storyline from the Ant-Man perspective. But now just bringing it to the screen, I think CGI would actually be probably the best way in order to bring him to the screen. Some real good CGI. You know, that's what I would think the best way to go as far as that's concerned. Yes, you can use an actor, but how long do you plan on really actually having him on the screen? You know, we had Hulk. We had an actor for the Hulk. When he's the Banner version, you know, but Hulk actually was CGI. It looked very good, very good, very good. So you could pull off Vision with a CGI situation. at the level that they're doing it right now, and it will look very good, very good. And what I see, Hollywood likes to keep things, it's difficult, but at the same time, it's simple. They don't like to get into too much extra this, extra that, extra this, you know, like the geeks and the nerds wish they would get into. Say, oh, it has to be done like this because this is this and this is that. Avengers is by no way broke, meaning which the way they did it, they nailed it down. They did it very well. Now you're just trying to add a little more icing and continue the money-making, thinking from the suit perspective, continue the money-making process. Let's add in a few characters. Let's do this and let's do that. That's all they're looking to do. So what I would do, I would CGI it. He would be on the screen maybe 10 to 15 minutes. You would see him in the backdrop in certain fight scenes and everything else, and there you go. And then you nail it down. Back over to you, Bert.
Well, you know, this also begs to ask, two questions, really. Will Marvel always have to be pegged to all their films being intermeshed, interrelated? Like, in other words, we know that Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, they all had to, and Hulk to a certain degree also, all of them had to mesh in some way to lead to the Avengers. Now we have yet another arc that I think it looks like it's going to go in that direction again, where they're going to have all these Marvel comic book properties going to film from this point on have to lead to the next Avengers, which means if you're going to have the Guardians of the Galaxy, if you're going to have Ant-Man, it makes you wonder, what Daryl hinted at this, the Ant-Man story, I mean, which would make it pretty interesting, is if there is an Ultron thing, this ultra genius, this super genius, and Hank Pym, and you're going to have some cameos in Ant-Man with the other Marvel people, but by and large, in order for there to be a Vision, I think, there would have to be that whole Ultron story and Ant-Man indirectly creating the Vision. Indirectly. Actually, Ultron created him, but Ultron was created by Pym.
Well, you could do it piecemeal too. You could have in the Ant-Man movie, all right? Well, Tony's been working on this artificial AI, or Stark Industries handed this over to us. Hank, take a look at this, all right? And we don't know that the AI program is probably Ultron. In the back, you can see bodies of synthesoids and robotics, you know, in the background. You know, it doesn't have to be forefronted like Captain America's shield. Come on, think about it. Well, in the first Iron Man, right? We didn't know about the plans for the Captain America movie. But how did the plans for the Captain America movie really take off? We all saw the Captain America shield hanging in the background of Tony's study. Like, how did he get Captain America's shield? And then from there, you know, we had the ice scene in the Hulk where everybody started seeing, oh, my God, is that Captain America frozen in the ice up there? You see that shadow? And it built, the anticipation built until we had to do a Captain America movie. Of course, we didn't like that Tony broke the shield to make that machine at the end of Iron Man 2. But, because we were like, what kind of crap shield is that? But at the same time, it built on it. The way to introduce the Vision in is you don't have to just come outright. I would love it to do Ultron outright, but you could introduce little parts in it concurrent to what they're going to do for the buildup of Thanos, provided they don't screw that up. You know, you could do it sort of like in the background, leave little clues, leave little nuggets that the general people won't get, but we'd be going crazy like, yo, you saw that? Brain patterns. They're going to use brain patterns. Oh, my God. Oh, we're building this up. I can't wait to see what they introduce next, you know, and we all geek out.
Yeah, Let's move along somewhat on the same subject now. With now, what about this Vin Diesel talk? Now, allegedly on his Facebook, this is where it gets somewhat mysterious. On Vin Diesel's Facebook, he allegedly had an avatar of himself as the Vision. So now there's talk there might have been talks behind the scenes of getting him involved in this property. Now, I'm not against him being involved in this for some reason. Marvel seems to not shy away from having name recognition. You have a Vin Diesel involved in this thing, just his name alone attached to it. It adds to the box office in some way. It makes it interesting. I know you may have your misgivings about his acting ability, but actually Vin Diesel can act. It's just a matter of what he's put in.
Well, hey, I look at it right now, what this is. This is like the evil Longoria going to it was the New York Comic Con a couple of years ago and buying a whole bunch of Black Widow graphic novels. Someone snapped the picture and went, oh my God, Eva Longoria wants to be the Black Widow. Making that jump, you know? There's no substance to it, just making the jump. Hey, I could put a picture of me dressed as Black Panther on Facebook right now. It doesn't mean, hey, yo, you see that? Donald B's in the running to be Black Panther. No, it ain't happening. And besides, I have too much of a gun for that anyway.
Well, wait a minute. Actually, I thought Eva Longoria was attached to...
Wasp.
To the Wasp. That could still go down.
Yeah, but, again, we tend to do this, and that's the age we're in with this social media and stuff. Someone puts up something like this, and then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, it's going to happen. Take a look. Imagine if we had this when Nicolas Cage did his Death of Superman thing like that. We'd have people with torches and spears in the street. No, Nicolas Cage can't be Superman.
But Nick Cage was attached to Superman at one point, though.
No, but what I'm saying is, we make the jump so quickly from something being posted on a Facebook thing with no substance, i.e. the Ben Affleck thing last week. You know, we make that jump. We go from A to M right away. And it's like the captain always says, why don't we just sit back and wait a second here? We don't have to immediately react. We heard the story. Let's wait for the substance. You know, be patient. All right? Hey, if Vin Diesel gets attached to it, I'm not going to particularly like it because I'm stoked for Clark Gregg. But at the same time, you know, like I said, Marvel's made few missteps so far. So if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, well, hey, guess what? That's the internet freaking giving you a meme. That's my first one today. Giving you that meme right there. Like, oh, you fell for it, suckers, once again.
Yeah. Can I say something? Vin Diesel regardless of how we feel about his acting ability, regardless of how we feel about his acting ability, he's a big draw. And Avenger movies is a monster. It is a monster. That movie is a monster. So, you want to make the monster even bigger, bring in Vin Diesel. You know, the weekend draw, when it comes out, there's going to be a lot of people with a mindset of Fast and Furious type of mindset. We have Vin Diesel in there. They hear that name. They're going to come into the theater. And I don't think necessarily Vin Diesel in this role would disappoint. I don't think he would disappoint. I'm not saying it would be awesome, you know. It's not like you get a Russell Crowe or somebody like that. But, you know, I don't think he would disappoint. That's just my opinion. Back with you, sir, Afro Nerd.
Just quickly, and then I think we should go to another musical break. I'm looking at IGN.com, and it says here, it's funny how these things can just go viral. This has been going on for the last 24 hours. It says, what happens when a movie star updates their profile pic with a Marvel character? Fanboy speculation kicks into overdrive. Bleeding Cool points out that Vin Diesel recently changed his Facebook profile pic to an image of the Marvel character Vision, the Android Avenger. Since Diesel uses his Facebook page primarily to pimp out his many projects, such as the forthcoming threequel, Riddick, tongues are now a-wagging that maybe the XXX and Fast and Furious star is dropping some hints that he is either A, up for the role or has been cast as the Vision in The Avengers 2, B, wants to play the character in the movie and is essentially baiting fans into creating a buzz campaign to get Marvel to consider him, or C, is just pranking his fans. So, you know, we're never going to know, but this is the way Hollywood operates. I mean, they will do, the stars will do slick stuff to get things going. You know, it's about being, you know, somewhat slick, somewhat sophisticated. You know, now that I think about it, he has the physical prowess to be the Vision, but I'm not against it. I'm kind of into this for some reason. We joked about the Iron Giant. I mean, he did the voice for the Iron Giant, which was a robot, a monosyllabic robot. But I think he can pull it off. I'm kind of excited about it, honestly.
Fast and Furious 7. Vision steals the Quinjet. Goes to Brazil. Here we go. Guest starring The Rock as Ultron. let's go. $2 billion in our reach.
Go ahead.
It's funny about these viral campaigns because, hey, Donald Glover did a viral campaign to be Spider-Man and it didn't work. So, hey, people like what they like, I guess.
Well, you know what? When many first heard that Robert Downey Jr. was going to be Tony Stark, you know, it didn't necessarily go over that well. Initially, it was like they couldn't put their heads around it, wrap their heads around it. Now you can't imagine anyone but him playing Tony Stark. So you never know until you actually see these things come to fruition. I'm just saying. I was guilty of it too. I was like, I knew he's a phenomenal actor, but I wasn't on board. Now I could not think of anyone else who embodies Tony Stark better than Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah,
You never know.
So this will even us up, because remember, back then I said he was perfect. It's art imitating life right there. He was made for this role. And you looked at me strange like, no. Robert Downey Jr. is Tony Stark. Well, if Vin Diesel's right, then we're even.
Yeah.
Because I want Clark Gregg, damn it.
All right, that's another thing. So I would like, you know, he's a fan favorite. You know, something else before we go to this musical break. This whole thing about all these TV and movie comic book creations and how they garner popularity and that in some way they have to be brought into the print universe. We saw that with Chloe from Smallville. We're seeing it now with Agent Coulson. He's in the Ultimate. I mean, he's actually in a regular Marvel universe. I mean, they brought him a few months ago with the Battle Scars. They brought him in. They had to wedge in. Yeah, and the Black Fury also. But they had to wedge in these characters from the cinematic universe because of their popularity. I find it hard to believe that this guy is not going to stick around.
Mm-mm. But the scary thing to me about that is Spider-Man 4. All right. Miles Morales asked Peter Parker, I wonder if there's a version of me in the regular Marvel Universe. I went like, oh, damn, did Bendis actually just write that? I know someone's going to try to shoehorn Miles Morales as like a Hispanic druggie in the regular Marvel Universe. Just watch out.
Well, you know, I hope they don't stick to that meme. I hope we don't get that. I would not be shocked. But, you know, be that as it may. Gentlemen, let's go to a quick musical break. This is, I guess in his way of honoring Johnny Quest, this is Mos Def performing Zim Zala Bim. Let's get into it. Let's groove. Zim Zala Bim, Mos Def.
Yes, 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 yes. Ha! Ghetto people! Ha! Yo, I'm loud with it.
no middle to high with it. And that's how I'ma live and die with it. Pull up and down your spine with it. Like Sims, Alabama, Jack Johnson. Yes, my dog, ride with them. The most special, most ghetto, most mental, most valuable. Rep my avenue like it's the damn state capital. Come and travel through minds of better mark of greatness. Some slaves who hijack the slave ship. The hackers who can back the matrix. And build a road back to basics. And get y'all all off that strange shit. Did all these other cats run game with? It's tainted. Consider this the moment to change it. Now, Jack Johnson, sandstorm, never bow down. Back off or get clapped on right about. Wow. From east to the west, up north to down south. We show you how to really make a march fit bounce. We show you how to really make the ghetto wild out. First letters that I wrote when I sketched the script down. I'm loud with it, no middle to high with it. And that's how I'm a living down with it. I shine with it, prime with it. Revered and recognized with it. The ghetto know what time is it. When I spit it, menage him it. I iron lion stride with it. These shots and no string or not, I make them proud with it. They look alive and get on rock with it.
But I just dig Mos Def, and I dig the fact that that name of the cut is called Zim's Alabim. Anyone who is familiar with Johnny Quest animated lore, that was his cohort Haji's code phrase. You know, before he went into some kind of mystical thing, when he wanted to create some kind of diversion, he would say Zim's Alabim. So I thought that was pretty cool that that particular cut, which is from the New Danger CD, from a few years back, Mos Def. Zim's Alabim. All right, folks, we got about 11 minutes remaining. Thanks for listening to the Comic Shop. We have Afner Radio coming up at 7 o'clock. The call-in number, 646-915-9620, 646-915-9620. Couple of quick things just off the cuff. I don't know if we ever actually discussed this. Dow, have you heard any solid talk about a potential, almost a Marvel-esque thing with the Man of Steel that we might see some reference to, if not the JLA, we might hear some reference to Wonder Woman in 2013's Man of Steel?
Well, yes, that's there. And yes, the one thing that I'll never criticize Nolan for is Nolan has wanted to do something like that, and now that he's overseeing it, you know, he wants to make a link to a bigger universe, okay? But he's been shut down every step of the way. But with the success of Avengers, ironically, it is now going to free him up to to, all right, you see how the bigger universe can pay us, pay off for us in the long run. Let me do this. And I think we're going to get something in Man of Steel to that effect. What it will it be? I don't know. But you know he really wants to do it. Because like Cap says, it's all about making money. It's all about green. And the bigger DC universe, a link with Superman to the bigger DC universe, that only means money in the long run. That shouldn't hurt it.
Yeah, well, you know, my only thing is, and this is to the captain, I don't see how Warner Brothers can avoid trying to tap into, and we know full and well, when you're talking about billion-dollar franchises, which we've seen Avengers being able to accomplish, I don't see how they can continue to make these standalone films and not be forced to tapping in into a similar Marvel situation. I don't see how they're going to have Man of Steel come out 2013 and then not have some passing reference to other heroes or something. Because how much time, I mean, you know, you can't go into 2020. You got to strike when the iron is hot. I mean, what are your thoughts on this, Captain? You think they're going to, don't they have to this film? I would be shocked that this film comes out and there's no reference to a JLA or to some other hero.
Well, Marvel, once again, set the tone. Front runners set the tone. DC essentially probably wanted to just do their standalone situation. It's easy. It's easy. Okay, it's easy. I'm going to just put out this movie. It's built in the noosphere, people. You know, Batman, Superman, no problem. Now here comes Avengers. Oh, now all the pieces on the board have moved. Now you have to try to figure out, calibrate. How do I do things? How do I do things now? Because it's too much money. It's too much money. You're dealing with potentially maybe up to the utmost, almost $2 billion. You understand? You definitely get to the billion-dollar part. It's too much money. It's too much money. So you have to recalibrate. For me personally, I want the Wonder Woman movie so bad. I want to see it out so bad, so bad. Even more so than the Superman movie. You know, I'm not really a Superman guy, but, you know, it looks good. So I give them their props. I'm a Batman first with everything, just so the audience knows. But I want this Wonder Woman movie. And I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely correct. They have to do something. They have to figure it out. But at the same time, you know, you have those individuals that say, I don't necessarily want to do it exactly the way Marvel did. But Marvel made a lot of money. Maybe we could figure out a way, you know, to put a little different flair, you know, on the way we do it somehow. But at the same time, introduce it and set it up, you know? Back over to you, D-Bert.
Yeah, you know, you know, one thing I'm kind of confused on is that, you know, Daryl just mentioned that, you know, Warner Brothers was pursuing Nolan to doing a JLA. From my understanding, I mean, he doesn't really want anything to do with this. I mean, I'm not so sure of him wanting to connect the dots. I mean, there's been a lot of pressure, I think, for him to connect the dots with his Batman. We see that's not going to happen. He refuses to do it. He is involved as far as the overseeing of this. It's basically Zack Snyder's film, but he is overseeing Man of Steel. But if he wasn't willing to connect the dots on Batman, I'm not so sure because of how Nolan is. I don't think Nolan really wants. I don't think he's comfortable in being the comic book guy.
Well,
you know what I mean. Josh Whedon is comfortable in being the comic book guy.
You're right.
Isn't that what it really is?
You're absolutely right.
Well, here it is too. And in the time he really wanted to do it, and we've talked about it in Dark Knight Returns, he really wanted to do it. We've talked about that. He had the scene ready with Clark Kent and Bruce Wayne. He had that ready to go, and it got nixed by the higher-ups.
Wait, Nolan did that. Wait, let me stop you. Nolan set this up?
Yes, Nolan had a scene ready to help with the Superman Returns, where you would have Clark Kent and Bruce Wayne, you know, like an interview type thing, not like a press conference. You wouldn't hear you wouldn't have heard Clark say anything, or maybe that, but you would have had him in the crowd with the trademark fedora and the glasses, and everybody would be left wondering, hey, did you see in the crowd of reporters there? What's that Clark Kent? What's that Clark? You know, just to build buzz. Would it be him? Would they stay with him? No, but it would be there to get everybody's energies and juices flowing, and then bam, here comes Superman Returns, and everybody's hyped for it. But that's just it. Warner Brothers mixed it, and I think right there, that soured Nolan to just the superhero concept when talking about DC in general. We've talked about wrong how he did not want to do a Robin. Oh, my God. He didn't want to do a Catwoman. But someone got to him, and he put Catwoman in the film. You know, and he put Robin in the film.
We only have about 4 minutes remaining, unfortunately, before we have to go next door for Afro Radio. But I was always under the impression that Nolan was so stuck in this real-world adaptation of Batman that he was uncomfortable in having some fantastical alien come in. Now, having seen the trailer for Man of Steel, to me it looked so earthy looking. It didn't have that fantasy look to it to me. It looked like it could have easily been. You could definitely see Nolan and Snyder. It didn't even look like a Snyder film. Snyder's film films, as far as how they look, have this glossy appeal. You know, whether it's Watchmen or what's the one he did with the girl that was fantasizing?
Sucker Punch.
Sucker Punch. But they have a certain Zack Snyder signature look. This Man of Steel didn't have it. It actually had more of a Nolan look, to be honest with you. This guy's bearded and the hitchhiking. It looks real to me. Well, listen, gentlemen, we only got about under 3 minutes. One quick thing. Daryl, this was in your piece again, folks. Go to afro.com for Daryl's entry. This thing with Seth Green. Is a special DC Comics robot chicken thing? Talk about that for about 30 seconds if you can.
Ha! Well, hey, they've skewered the hell out of Star Wars. Better than what Family Guy did. Robot Chicken did, all right? They've skewered the hell out of stuff like He-Man and Transformers and other properties. You knew the DC Comics thing was coming since one of the writers on it is Geoff Johns. You knew that this was coming. So here we go. We're going to have it sometime in September. The Robot Chicken DC Universe Special. And if you remember the real world Metropolis and how batshit, sorry for the language, but how they got under comic book fan skin at the same time making them laugh hard as hell, prepare for a whole episode involving that. It's going to be nuts. It is. And one last call out for me. I may rip it a lot, but Ultimate Spider-Man, that was a great job with that little tribute to Dwayne McDuffie with the damage control episode. I got to give you guys credit for that. You know, you had the boss even sounding like McDuffie. I don't know who did the voice for it, but good job. Back to you, Afternoon.
You know, we got to get out of here, unfortunately, and go next door to Afternoon Radio. We forgot to talk about the new Ben 10, incidentally. We'll talk about that next Sunday, folks. I'm sure Dow is trying to get the bit to talk about that. That's a bottle. Anyway, I think we can agree on that. All right, gentlemen, as always, we appreciate it. We have to interview Mr. Norman Kelly coming up in a few moments. It's been an absolute pleasure, absolute ride. Let's go on out with Spock
and
the Beer. Thank you. Going next door.
Spock with a beard?
I think not. I'm not guilty. You're the one who's guilty. Lawmakers, the politicians, the Colombian drug lords, all you who lobby against making drugs legal, just like you did with alcohol during the Prohibition, you're the one who's guilty. I mean, come on, let's kick the ballistics here. Ain't no Uzis made in Harlem. I mean, not one of us in here owns a poppy field. This thing is bigger than Nino Brown. This is big business. This is the American way.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to enter this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else.
Hawk, who goes yonder?
It is I, sire, Richard of Nottingham.
Well, speak up, man. What is it?
News from the east, sire. Rick the Ruler has returned.
It's abracadabra, a la baby professor. All hail funk and lesson. Sweet tongue, grand writer of scrolls. Now behold, let the legend unfold. Born in the cosmos, where no time and space do exist. Vibe in the midst of the chaos. Mortals label me as a locker.
You're traveling to another radio show. A broadcast not only of sight and sound, but of models. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of the imagination. That's the on-air sign up ahead. Your next stop, Afro Nerd Radio, with your guide, D-Bert, a.k.a. Afro Nerd.
Good evening, folks. Good evening. Your host, D-Bert, a.k.a. the Afro-Nerd, and welcome to yet another edition of Afro-Nerd Radio featuring Captain Kirk. The call-in number, 646-915-9620, 646-915-9620. Mr. Norman Kelly, coming back for round two, author of some fascinating books, actually. One, The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, and of course, Rhythm in Business. We spoke to this gentleman a few weeks ago, and we just had to get him back, bring him back into the fold to discuss some of the things going on for this Week in Review episode. Before we get into the discourse, we've got to get into the funk. This is DMSR, Dance, Music, Sex, Romance. You know who. Let's groove. Just as Jack Nicholson said, you can't handle the truth. I'm not sure our audience can handle the funk. That's DMSR, a classic from the 1999 DVD. Well, I was going to say CD. Actually, it was at the time it was a tape. It was a record. The album by Prince, Dance Music Sex Romance. Okay, listen. Time for the show. 646-915-9620. Captain, you're needed on the bridge. Let's get to it.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Done that in a while. Let the whole thing run. Been cutting it short of late. Sorry about that, people. But let's get the show started. Back over to you, Sir Afro Nerd.
Yes, actually, I think we have our special guest, I believe. I'm clairvoyant that way, Captain. I'm clairvoyant that way. Norman?
Yes?
Welcome once again to Afro Nerd Radio. How's
hey,
it going?
Thank you for having me. How are you doing? Oh, please, stop, please.
Listen, as promised, we had to get you back because we had a great conversation, and I felt like you were part of the crew because we were talking about some of the things that are going on in today's culture, politically, socially, and things have not changed. Things have perhaps worsened in this just this week alone, so we figured we would bring you back in. I have to admit that I really do love your books that you've written, but it's especially the HNIC. And I love the book because I thought it was clairvoyant as to what we're dealing with now, but also just how does it measure up with Barack Obama, President Obama now? And now we see everyone is feeding at the trough right now.
Right.
We don't know if he's going to have a second term. We see Paul Ryan is another player in this thing, so we wanted to bring you in. Now, just to reacquaint you with our audience, you have this book, The HNIC Syndrome, The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome. Can you just for the sake of the audience, go into the premise of the book, and then we can move forward?
Well, the basic premise of the book is that the 40 years post-civil rights political culture of Black America had not produced leadership or any mechanism to solve real problems. What you started to have were these sort of, although you had a large number of Black elected officials, they seemingly were more interested in just playing the game of being Black, of being elected officials. And then you had these self-appointed leaders like a Jesse Jackson, and Al Sharpton, a Louis Farrakhan. And then normally what they would do is that what Jackson did in, I believe, 84 and 88, he ran for the presidency. He gathered a bunch of votes, Black votes, and he parlayed those votes into a position for himself within the Democratic Party apparatus. Same thing with Al Sharpton. He ran for an election, didn't do very well, and then whatever he got, he parlayed that to a speaking position for himself. Reverend Farrakhan did the Million Man March. That didn't do very much of anything other than bringing a sizable number of Black men together to Washington, D.C., and as somebody once put it, to protest themselves. And he never did anything with that. So the premise of the book was just like looking at where had Black political culture had developed 40 years after the Civil Rights Movement. And my analysis was it had come to a dead end, that nobody was saying anything, and Black independence of Black politics had pretty much just demobilized. There weren't any movements going on. You had a Democratic Party that usually would just take all of black political activity was shunted through the Democratic Party, and nothing much was going on with that. And the interesting thing about Barack Obama was that I was hoping that he would be an exception to the rule, and in some ways he was, because at the very least, he ran for offices in which he won, and so he actually got a hold of state power. Now, he got a hold of state power, though, when the economy had declined, and now it's pretty iffy if he will get back in office. I mean, I think it's a 50-50 chance that he will not. I think it's also a 50-50 chance that he may. And it all depends on, you know, how well he organizes the ground game, as they're saying. Because right now, as you probably know, Desmond, the Republicans are beating him at the money trough.
Yes. Yes, they are. They're taking in more money than him.
Which has never happened before for an incumbent president.
And you know, I mean, there's a couple of things I want to get into with you on this thing, because with President Obama, first of all, in 07, 08, I was somewhat disappointed, somewhat taken aback by how he was treated as a young man pursuing the highest office in the land, and how the institutional black leaders, whether it was Andy Young,
mm-hmm.
he said some pretty nasty things.
Right.
Even though Reverend Al Sharpton is in camp with, or he's in the Obama camp now.
Well, he knows where the power
during election time, he said some pretty nasty things. There were quite a few high level, high ranking black folk of note.
Well,
Bob Johnson, who I'm a fan of
BET. Now, this is interesting. There's a new book that came out by a professor, I think, at Emory University in Georgia. It's called The New Black Politician. And her thesis is that Barack Obama represented a new black political generation. And basically, her thesis is that this new black political operators, they don't come out of the traditional civil rights history and milieu. They had taken advantage, they were able to go to school and take advantage of those doors that were open to them but had been denied to previous generation. So the way that the previous generation treated Obama was pretty much in play as to how this woman, Audrey Gillespie, analyzed it in her book called The New Black Politician, which is put out by New York University Press. And Cory Booker, Adrian Fenty of Washington, D.C., and Arthur Davis, formerly Alabama governor, she all put, including the president, she put these four to five gentlemen in this whole category of a new black politician. And she called them new black political operators because they have a tendency not to come out of the traditional civil rights background, and they operated against them in a certain way. And there's certain things that they would do to undermine the elected officials that they were running against. So you were pretty much on course about how the previous establishment black generation, political generation, was treating Obama.
I mean, one would think that with the sacrifice that Dr. King had made and many other noted civil rights leaders, that this was supposed to happen. At some point, we were supposed to see someone who could appeal to a cross-racial populace and become a president with coming from an African-American experience. So I did not want to believe
right.
that these people, many of whom I grew up to admire, I was an admirer I just mentioned his name.
Andrew Young.
Mm-hmm. You know, how could you not admire his accomplishments?
But you also have to look at their vested interests. See, this is the other thing that we all have to start looking at as student of politics. And Adolf Reed, who's at the University of Pennsylvania, who's a black political scientist, said you also have to look at the vested interest that class, that generation has, and nobody wants to give it up. I mean, like, basically, once Obama became the black leader, so to speak, he pretty much knocked off the pedestal Al Sharpton. He knocked off the pedestal Jesse Jackson. So each of these guys had a vested interest in perhaps not seeing this new generation come in. And that's all what happens. You know, like the older generation doesn't want to, you know, within certain realms, doesn't want to give up power. Eventually they will because, you know, we all leave this earth at some point. But while they're there, they don't want to give up power. They don't want to give up influence. They are the black leaders. I mean, and Obama doesn't position himself as one, but by default he is. Although it's kind of ironic that basically I had this theory that the great irony of Barack Obama was that Barack Obama may be the epitome of black political achievement at the same time black economic development went down the toilet.
You know, I wanted Catherine to come in, but I have some questions leading into that as well that I think that the audience might actually enjoy. Catherine, any questions for Norman?
Yes. It's Captain speaking. How's it going, Norman?
I'm fine. How are you, Captain?
Tremendous, tremendous. Now, is Obama the head Negro in charge, or is he the scapegoat for every president's misgivings after JFK leading up to now?
Well, my thesis is that by the fact that he was not self-appointed, that he ran and he achieved political power, he is not a head Negro in charge the way I categorize Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. I would say that I tend to think of Barack Obama as a magical Negro, meaning that once he got into office, all the problems of race would, like, disappear. And we all know that turned out to be a fallacy because when he became president, all these submerged, sort of like racist kind of like things that whites have held against black people started to just, you know, just like break up, come to the surface. And you just see some pretty – I mean, this guy has been called – everything in the book. He's been called a traitor. He's been called a Marxist, a socialist. He's been called a Muslim numerous times. This man has been, he's been defiled regularly. And I always say his greatest political achievement, you know, while President of the United States is probably not being assassinated, given the fact that he's been demonized in such a way, why wouldn't you go and track this guy down?
Wow, that is something. I think about that myself, actually.
Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, I have this theory that if he gets elected again, this period right now that we're in kind of eerily reminds me, according to my readings, because I did a literary period, of the pre-Civil War era, where there's great polarization going on over slavery.
I agree.
And Lincoln comes, and, you know, you have Bleeding Kansas. I don't know if you gentlemen know your history. You know that out in the Midwest, there was all this conflagration going on between who was a slave state and a free state.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And, yeah, you have all that shooting going on. You know how we are as a people, Americans. We're armed to the teeth always, and we don't solve problems by sitting down. We pull out a gun. So, and then you had Harper's Ferry.
Right.
I mean, like, now you have all these shootings going on in this country. Some of them are political. Some of them are apolitical. But you had this great ferment. You have this sort of, like, polarization. The economy isn't working well. I mean, it's on the mend, but it's not on the mend as quickly as it should be. And I kind of feel like, you know, like if he gets in, if he gets back in, I really wouldn't be surprised if somebody really does take a shot at this guy. You know, or try to do something really stupid, Harper Ferry's like. I mean, because you've got this really weird. I mean, something has to break because the polarization going on within Congress and the political parties. You know what Lincoln said: a house divided cannot stand. Something has to give at some point, and it seems to be, hopefully, is working its way towards that. I just hope it's not through a violent mechanism.
Well, you know, there's something we discussed actually last week. It made a little bit of noise. For some reason, it didn't really stick around that long. But the comedian D.L. Hughley has a new book. I believe the book is "Get the F." I want you to get the F or shut the F up. Something kind of vulgar.
Yeah.
Something kind of. But he has him as a
STFU.
Yeah, he has him as a as Uncle Sam, dressed in Uncle Sam's uniform.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, that famous pointing to you
right.
for the army kind of thing.
Right.
And his whole thing now, and I've been hearing this a lot. I've heard it a number of occasions. Well, you know, he said something to him, something about, well,
President Obama reminds him of someone, of a white kid or a white person, because he doesn't react to all the, like what you just said, all the vitriol that's out there. He's not reacting to it, and that a quote unquote real black person would be would react in a certain way. I think, you know, during the, if you remember the infamous State of the Union address.
Oh,
where
right.
I believe it was a senator that spoke
out of
turn.
No, congressman from South Carolina, Joe Wilson.
Right, I'm sorry. Right, you're right. Mm-hmm. And he said to him, you know, you lie.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that he should have had him removed. I said, you're not.
No, you're not a king.
Now,
Desmond, I thought about this too. Now, if I were, this is what Obama should have done. Given who he is, he should have just stopped and he should have said something like, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you ever wonder why our politics is so corrosive, I have Exhibit A," you know, and
right,
just pointed up there
right.
and said, "Well, sir, do you want to say anything more?" You know, and then he probably wouldn't say anything. Then turn around to the Speaker of the House, "Mr. Speaker, do I have the permission to continue?" You know, and then go on. And that would have shut him up, because then what Obama would have done, because he's a very calm guy, he would have turned the cameras on them, embarrassed the party, and just said, "Look, folks, I am duly constituted to come here once a year and report to you, the American people, and your representatives, how the state of the nation is. And it's really shocking that I cannot come here and do my constitutional duties in a polite manner without being interrupted. We all know that you're trained, you don't do this." I mean, just do it like that. It doesn't have to break bad and be, allow me to use the N-word, and I'll say, he doesn't have to act like a nigger. I mean, he's an intelligent man. He should have used his power like that to embarrass this guy that way. He would have gotten more points that way to do that. You do that in public, and then behind the cloak of night, you do your dirty work. You know, you get somebody to take this guy out or something like that. But, you know, like, when you're on the stage like that, and given who he is, he doesn't have to act like that. Actually, I think Hugh Lee is wrong. You don't have to act like that. That is not the way every black person is going to act. And we don't stop getting to the idea that the only real authentic nigger is somebody standing on a corner with a bandana around his head, drinking 40s, you know, and having, like, 5 illegitimate children. I mean, come on. I mean, like...
Well, that's one of the things that we talk about at Afronerd incessantly, and I think that's kind of what we're fighting. And I think it seems funny that when you're dealing with the D.L. Hughley, who comes from a certain environment, I mean, he makes no bones about him coming from California, and I think he might have had some, you know, he would classify him as a street black, more than likely, I would say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's believing that because Barack Obama is more cerebral.
Yeah, but that's not black.
That is not black, and I'm bringing this to you because also there's this whole thing about, and I think President Obama, I believe in Black Enterprise magazine, said something that we all knew, that he is not the president of Black America.
Right.
But when he said that, you know, there's some people that took umbrage with him saying it that way, but that is the truth. There's no president of color will ever be. I don't care if Malcolm X came back and was elected. He would not be the president of Black America as long as white folks have influence, and as long as he's in the quote unquote White House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what I'm saying to you is the premise is President Obama is not doing anything for black people. That's what you're hearing from a certain segment. What is the black agenda?
There isn't any anymore. I mean, that's basically what my HNIC book was trying to talk about. That there is not. There's nothing, anything particularly wrong about that per se. I would be happier if there were more black political mobilization, you know, and that you could punish the people who threaten your interests. You know, the black political agenda was getting, you know, Barack Obama into office, which is fine. Ironically, that the time that he took power was at the same time the economy tanked. And we all know that black political economic development, particularly for the black middle class, was really pretty much wiped out. Not totally wiped out, but it took a very big hit. And the interesting thing about Obama is that on one level, Obama doesn't want to say anything that positions him as the black leader because He never ran on that. And as a matter of fact, if he did run on that, he would not be elected. And to a certain degree, it was good for him not to run on that, because everything that affects us as a nation affects us collectively, although ironically, some people tend to get hurt more so in certain realms than other people. But, you know, like he, you know, but when Obama does take a quote-unquote pro-black position, then he gets pilloried for it. You know that thing that happened with Henry Louis Gates.
Of course.
You know, he just said the police did something stupidly. If he had just said something like, well, I think it was very odd. And, you know, whatever else he said, it just said, I think it was very odd that the police arrested a man, blah, blah, blah. It's just like he can make, Obama can make points like that just by, you know, saying things in his own fashion that will get the point across. Some people won't understand because he's not doing the break a buck dance, as they say, and hooping and hollering and talking about people's mamas and stuff like that. Fine, they don't get it. That's the whole point of education. Maybe down the road, they don't get it. They'll get it down the road. Maybe their children who are watching, they'll say, wow, this is an intelligent black guy doing this and saying this. That means I don't have to act like that. I don't have to act like the rest of these knuckleheads out here.
Norman, one quick thing. I want to take a quick musical break. As you know, we try to promote urban alternative music, so we're trying to do not the minstrel stuff.
Well,
so let's go to a quick musical break. When we get back, I want to ask you more about this notion of a black agenda. My feeling is that if President Obama were to really implement what black folks or some black folks are asking for, they may not like it. I suspect,
let's talk about it. I'd be interested in seeing your point about that, because that's an interesting premise.
I'll get to it after this break. We'll be right back. This is Janelle Monáe, Mr. President, coincidentally. Janelle Monáe performing Mr. President. We'll be back in a few moments. Let's groove.
Money that you spend,
food is falling low.
Okay, folks, I had to pull out the phaser on that one. That was a game, the great Janelle Monáe, Mr. President. Coincidentally, we were talking about President Barack Obama. That was Mr. President by Janelle Monáe. The call-in number is 646-915-9620, again, 646-915-9620. We're talking to Norman Kelly, author, journalist of such books as The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, The Dead End of Black Politics, and, of course, R&B, Rhythm and Business, The Political Economy of Black Music. Norman, before we went to the musical break, we were talking about the notion of a black agenda.
Right.
And I've been thinking about this for a minute now, actually. And my belief is, first of all, as you stated, you hinted at this before, you intimated that we do not have a black agenda. We do not have a codified plan or paradigm to present to the president.
Now, you also know historically there have been several attempts at that. During the 70s, there was a national black political conventions that went on in Gary, Indiana, and a few other places that tried to articulate a black agenda, and they kind of fell apart because one half of the political spectrum was more of a nationalist bent, typified by Mary Baraka. And then you had the other half, and these were the new guys who were just coming in, were more geared towards, you know, mainstream Democratic / Republican, you know, politics. So there was an attempt. There have been several attempts to have a national political agenda, but they've all kind of like fallen through the wayside because, you know, black people are not a monolith except for, you know, voting for the Democratic Party.
Well, my belief is that if we were to have, if Barack Obama were to implement some kind of black agenda, it would be akin to something that many, especially Democratic leadership, black leadership as we know it today, you know, the same cast of characters that you noted in your book,
mm-hmm.
that crew would come out hard against him.
So what would you think that would be?
Well, there's going to be – we're talking about the high crime rate. Like, for instance, what's happening in Chicago.
Right.
Chicago has perhaps the highest crime rate in the country, even surpassing Philadelphia right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're likening what's happening in Chicago to 70s Beirut. So
wow.
if that is the case –
mm-hmm.
Where you're talking about infants being killed, the elderly are being killed. We're talking about collateral damage being put upon folks that have nothing to do with the gang violence. They just happen to be there. If that's the case, you would have to bring in some kind of martial law. And I don't foresee that happening.
Right.
It would have to, honestly, we can talk about some of the problems that might have to be addressed. You know, some of the structural problems.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're dealing with an immediate solution to ameliorate some of the actual deaths, you're going to have it. In New York, we have the stop and frisk law, which many in the black establishment, black political establishment, do not like.
Well, I think also a lot of the citizens, black citizens, don't like it either. You know, you're walking down the street, you know, you're going to do your job, and you get stopped and frisked, you know. Clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. I mean, and no probable cause.
You would think that, but in Chicago specifically,
mm-hmm.
actually, some of the citizenry are actually asking for it.
In New York,
we have a problem with it. But
mm-hmm.
in Chicago, the citizens are asking for it now because it's over the top.
But now, you always have to remember that always how these things start off. Now, remember during the crack epidemic?
Right.
There was a lot of this stuff going on back then. And what happened, and people tend, these are the unintended consequences of things. People whose communities were inundated with crack and the same kind of violence that's happening in Chicago, they were making pleas to their black elected officials at the congressional level. They go to Washington, they get Congress to put in these draconian laws, which in the immediacy cleaned up the problem. But then you had this, you know, three strikes out, you know, at the local level. And then you also had these disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine time in jail. you know. And now when you try to clean that up, you know, it's hard to get that stuff cleaned up. And people tend to forget.
Drug laws, right.
Yeah, you know. And then, well, that was at the state level, you know, in New York. But then you had this federal sentencing and disparaging, you know, and disparity for powder and crack cocaine. And now, years later, when people try to get that cleaned up, you can't get it cleaned up because it takes, you know, because Congress, you know, in its infinite wisdom, doesn't want to do anything. But people tend to forget that got put in because of the whole controversy over crack cocaine and the violence. So now you have these people in Chicago, which I can well understand. And maybe in a certain circumstance like that, you really have to clamp down on those neighborhoods. But, you know, this is sort of like the unintended consequences of things happening. Now you got a whole generation of people right now who have gone to jail, and when they get out of jail, they can't get jobs and they can't vote because of the disparity between, you know, having a little bit of crack cocaine and a little bit of just powder cocaine. But, you know, like, that's what – I mean, look, do you know why the violence is going on in Chicago? Because I don't. I've been reading about it off and on, but it doesn't. I never seem to get anything. Is it like drug related? Is like, are these drug wars going on? I'm just curious. I don't know.
Well, I'm gonna go to a caller, but I'll say just briefly. From my understanding, a lot of it is to do with the gangs,
with turf wars
with the fractured element of the gangs. These gangs, mm-hmm. where they start to fraction off into mm-hmm. smaller subgroups.
Okay.
That's at issue too. I mean, they can talk about the joblessness, the poverty, but
mm-hmm.
specifically we're talking about gang violence, gangs running rampant, and unfortunately you're hearing more of the victims are children.
I've been hearing about that. Yeah.
Completely the innocents. I mean, literally collateral damage. Let's
mm-hmm.
open up the lines. We have a caller here. Okay, caller, welcome to Afternet Radio. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from. 215. Hello, caller, 215.
Okay, I guess we move on to the next one.
Okay, all right, let me try one more time. It seems like a familiar number. Let me try one more time. Caller, 215, welcome to Afternet Radio. Hello? All right. Be that as it may.
Well, okay.
Right.
I mean, let's go back to the black agenda. Okay.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's – okay. One of the problems that has never been dealt with, and it gets pushed underneath the rug, is the high rate of illegitimate birth within, you know, the black community. Daniel Moynihan wrote a book – no, he didn't write a book. He wrote a paper called the Moynihan Report, and it was pillared because basically he was talking about illegitimate birth. And the black political establishment didn't like that because they wanted to talk about civil rights and racism. So that problem never got dealt with. Now, Obama, over the years since he's been president, he has made arguments about, you know, the high rate of illegitimate birth. And a class of black men who impregnate women, you know, have them bear their children and don't take care of them. Now, if a white person says this, he's a racist. If a black person says this, well, you know, we got other problems to deal with. And it gets swept underneath the rug. I mean, it was 25%, I think, when Moynihan pointed it out. Now it's up to 70.
Senator Moynihan's report was definitely land-based. I think it came out around, 67 around that time?
Yeah, 65, 66. Because that's when Johnson was in office.
It was heavily land-based,
mm-hmm.
heavily critiqued, considered racist actually at the time.
Right.
And the numbers, I would pray for the numbers that you just referenced. It was at that point around, as you said, 20-25 percentile range for out-of-wedlock births. Now we're talking about 70, 75, 80% now.
Yeah.
It's grotesquely worse.
I know.
And it was the harbinger of things to come.
Yeah, but see,
That's
and now this is probably why you have these kids, these young men running around shooting the hell out of each other in the neighborhood, because they're probably brought up in families, in broken families.
Well, this is what I'm getting to mm-hmm. about we are our worst enemy, if I'm going to be tribal in this conversation. I have a thing about that. As you know, from the last show, I have a thing about tribalism. But because I don't believe all of us should be going over the cliff.
No.
I just can't. We have to start making – we have to start employing some degree of discernment as to who is who.
Right.
But anyway.
No, I
anyway,
mean, look, every community has the right to protect itself, and the most antisocial elements in that community cannot prey upon the rest. That's why we have laws. That's why we separate the most antisocial, violent ones from the rest of us, so the rest of us can go on and live our lives in peace and make, you know, make our own other mistakes that are not lethal. You know, so
this goes to my point, and I would like for you to kind of elaborate on this. This goes to my point about Barack Obama, President Obama, in the sense that his difficulty in even being able to implement a black agenda would be, you know, if it was going to be an actual effective agenda. That, you know, we saw shadows of this when he talks, you know, when he goes into a discussion before a black church and goes into a Cosby-esque cadence. About self empowerment, looking at ourselves culturally, getting a handle of some of the things that we're doing internally, as you just mentioned, the out of wedlock births and those kind of things. Because some of these things are becoming culturally expected and acceptable. We spoke about this a few weeks ago.
Well, yeah.
You know, now they have Father's Day cards that say "Happy Father's Day, Mom." Happy Father's Day, Mom. So, in other words, you have business now. Hallmark has made – this is true. This has been going on for actually two years straight now.
I didn't know that.
From how bad it is. Last year, they started this line of Father's Day cards for mothers because of the single mother syndrome.
So basically meaning that mothers are fulfilling both roles.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
They have codified that.
Wow.
Now, that's caused somewhat of a storm, but what happens is – it comes and goes based on the holiday.
Yeah,
I'm not
going
to forget it.
Right.
Actually, I just heard about this Father's Day.
I have to look out.
But,
I will look out for that next year. Wow.
But it dates back the last Father's Day. It caused a little bit of a storm. Then it moved along. We're into year two, and this has become an accepted meme culturally. So when Barack Obama comes out and talks about this stuff in a predominantly black church, some black folk take umbrage with him because it's in earshot of white folks.
I know. That's the whole dirty laundry syndrome. I mean, which is ridiculous because think about this, Desmond. As you probably know, black people in this country are the most studied people in the world. So there's almost nothing going on in our community that the dominant society doesn't know. Maybe not in great detail, but there's this illusion that, well, you shouldn't talk about this, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you know, look, we used to have a tradition of self-criticism.
That is true.
W.B.E.B., Du Bois argument with Booker T. Washington, what's a back and forth about the best way to solve the political problems. You ever read The Miseducation of the Negro by Carter G. Wilson?
Right.
Okay. I mean, like, we've had traditions of self-criticism. Black E. Franklin Frazier, Black Bourgeoisie, Michelle Walls, Black Macho, the Myth of the Superwoman. We have had traditions of self-criticism. And when those books are written, they're read by black people and white people and anybody else. So this whole thing about, well, you shouldn't say these things because they're in earshots of white people, that shows you how black culture has regressed.
Well, listen. This is why we do what we do. One of my favorite periods of history in history is the Harlem Renaissance.
Oh yeah.
And you know, this was typical. I mean, you would go to the Dark Tower, the famed Dark Tower, and they would have the elite at that time, the black elite, have discussions at the Dark Tower.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You know, a lot of that has to do with the whole thing of, you know, putting the best of the race forward, you know, being a race man, and then that sort of stuff. You know, like, and historically, you also had to remember that, like, whites who didn't have good faith would always come up with ways to use certain arguments against black people. Well, the criminals. Well, you know, some black folks were criminals, and a lot, and some were. Some were poor. But just because you're poor doesn't mean you're a criminal. So I can see where some of that was coming from. So, well, you know, we got to put the best foot forward. We got to put our best people forward, blah, blah, blah. But, like, those days are over with. I mean, like, and you know, we should have a tradition and be more open about what is going on within our neighborhoods, within our communities, that we have some control over, you know. But, you know, people, it's always, as you probably know, it's always easier to get out of the white man who commits an act of racism rather than getting after the black guy who does something stupid and violent and has a greater multiplying effect within the black community.
Well, you just had me think of something. Unless that white man is Democratic. Now, as a segue, we know that Vice President Biden,
mm-hmm.
I do need to talk about this.
Okay.
Vice President Biden, before a mixed audience, he used a comment. He made a slavery reference. Normally I would have a clip, but I didn't have enough time.
Well, yeah, I know what he said. He had
this chain. He had talked about unchaining Wall Street,
mm-hmm.
then he quickly went into putting black people, well, the belief, the inference is putting black people back in chains.
Now,
the right are saying that, well, if we had done this or said that, we would have been, you know, tarred and feathered.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts? I mean, what do you think was really going on?
Even with
his black cadence, y'all, what do you think is going on with this?
Well,
with
me, it's a good example. Look, I'm totally bored with this election. I think this is one of the – I don't know whether – people say it's one of the nastiest. I don't know about that. Could be. From what I read, there have been much nastier ones than this prior to the media. I think it's incredibly silly, and this is the sort of stuff that the media latches onto these gaffes that people make. Romney and his dog. I remember this thing about Romney and his dog 4 years ago. I heard this before. Why are we bringing this back? I mean, to me, Biden's quote-unquote gaffe is much ado about nothing. Everybody says the media loves this stuff. This is one of the reasons why I've gotten so sick of modern American political journalism. That's all these people do. They latch on to they'll latch on to that, but they miss the bigger point of him talking about how Wall Street is being unshackled or how Romney and them want to, like, do away with the regulations, which will lead us to the same problems that caused the downfall of the economy to begin with. That gets lost, and people concentrate on, oh, he says something about slavery. People are running around. And I find this is juvenile, you know, Desmond. American politics has become incredibly stupid, venal, and juvenile. I dread every presidential election because it gets worse. It gets stupider and stupider. And now you got, I mean, we got really serious problems going on, and nobody wants to really talk about it. Or when they do talk about it, if you say one gaffistic word, that's the only thing that people remember you saying rather than your bigger point, which means you can't say anything. So then politicians don't want to say anything at all because that's only media just like concentrates on.
Yeah, you know, I'm wondering about what the Republicans are saying. Do you think there's some degree of truth in the sense that if a Republican were to make a similar remark, that it would have been
– The problem with that argument is that if you go back and look at look at the remark that Newt Gingrich was making about Obama being the food stamp president.
Food stamp president, right.
I mean, if you want to really look at that, Jon Stewart did a brilliant analysis of that on The Daily Show. He did a rundown of all the racist I wouldn't say racist. I have a term called neo-racist. NEO-RACIST, neo-racist stuff, mm-hmm. that the Republican Party has engaged in with this president for the past 3.5 years. I mean, it's just like, I mean, the Republicans are very good at crying victim. Of course, there is a double standard going on in anything, pretty much, depending on who's saying it and who's reporting on it from the other perspective. But I just really cannot shed a tear or find fault with what Biden said when the Republican Party says some of the most outrageous things, if not themselves. They allow their conservative friends to say the most outrageous things, neo-racist things about this president. I mean, I don't care at this. I mean, to me, the election is boring because it is so juvenile at at this point. And not only that, it goes on for too long. This thing's been going on since last year, the Republican primary. A couple of days ago, I just got reminded that Michelle Bachmann won the straw poll about a couple, maybe Friday or Saturday, a year ago. And then went, wow, this thing's been going on for a year. I mean,
yeah,
it goes on for too long.
It has been dragging. I believe the captain has a question. Captain.
Sir.
Hey, how's it going once again? Now,
Captain, you got a great voice, man. You got, you know, do you act?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's what they tell me. Okay. Now, let's just say, hypothetically speaking, if Romney got into the office, became the president, do you think there will be any changes, or is just more of the same for Americans?
I would suspect that whatever he has planned for deregulating the economy and doing, well, he said he's going to get rid of Obamacare, which may be hard for him to do, depending on that would depend on who's in the House and the Senate. I will suspect that he will try to implement the Ryan plan, a budgetary plan, because he said he liked it before he even selected Ryan, and I'm quite sure they will try to implement that. So I do think there will be some changes. I think basically Romney will probably be more beholden to the if the Republicans get control if control of the House still remains in Republican hands, that would give him greater impetus to put some of his agenda in. If the Democrats hold on to the Senate, that will block some of it. And we'll still be at a stalemate to some degree. I will suspect that we will probably be attacking Iran, or we will give the go-ahead to attack Iran, because that seems to be our favorite thing, going over to the Middle East and killing Arabs.
That's been talked about. I hope that's not the case.
I had to step back from that because not technically, Iranians are not Arabs. They're
mm-hmm.
Persians, but they're
right.
Muslims, so it doesn't matter.
One thing I was thinking about also with now that since last week, Governor Romney has stated that Paul Ryan is going to be his right-hand man.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a number of pieces written on the Internet claiming this whole BWG, boring white guy syndrome. and that is the first thing that came to my mind. I do have a hard time understanding. It seems as if we're going to go backwards. Like,
mm-hmm.
the whole, just aesthetically,
mm-hmm.
the I think there is such a thing as a boring white guy thing. Won't this really be this election? Isn't this more of a referendum on having a person of color in that position? That, you know, anybody but a black person now? Are we to be honest about this? I mean, it does appear. I mean, you would have thought that, and I'm saying this as a conservative, you would have thought that on the right side, they might have chosen someone who was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Bobby Jindal from Louisiana.
Right.
They would have added something
flavor.
In the mix. Some flavor to make it a little bit more interesting. But to have to follow the same meme of two white guys with the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something about it? Listen, this has been written up by many legitimate places claiming this BWG, this boring white guy thing.
Well, you know, I don't know whether it's the aesthetics of it, but, you know, some people have said that they think that, you know, Ryan will make it easier for, you know, working-class whites to vote for the, you know, GOP ticket. I mean, from what I understand, you know, Ryan is from a very wealthy, and not as wealthy as Romney, but you know,
enough.
He's from a pretty good background. I mean, the thing about Ryan is that a lot of the things that he's now complaining about that's gone on under this present administration, he voted for under Bush. I mean, let me read you quickly from the New Yorker, August 6th, on Fuss Budget by Ryan Lizza. Ryan was a reliable Republican vote for policies that were in key, causing enormous federal budget deficits, sweeping tax cuts, a costly prescription drug entitlement for Medicare, two wars, a multi-billion-dollar bank bailout, legislatively known as TARP. In all, $5 trillion was added to the national debt. And not only that, it has just been revealed by Chris Hayes on his show Up that there's a 2002 C-SPAN clip of Ryan arguing for stimulus spending under the Bush administration, using the exact same words that a Democrat would use to promote the stimulus spending.
That's what I'm inferring.
Yeah.
That they take umbrage with this quote unquote Obamacare, mm-hmm. but there was Romneycare before Obamacare.
Well, there you
have Romneycare. The wording of Obamacare is Romneycare.
The whole intellectual architecture of both those things, or at least some of the Obamacare, came out of the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank.
So,
whatever the other team is for, I'm against.
This is what makes it problematic for me, even as a conservative. I don't have a problem with Barack Obama, actually, because I think he has shown himself to be more of a centrist, at least he's trying to be a centrist, which is to the chagrin of those on the left and of those on the right. But, you know, all things are due in moderation. So I believe in centrism. But what I'm getting at is with whether it's the Obamacare, Romneycare argument, or even with Ryan having to now he has to disparage Ayn Rand, which I find interesting. He was in love with this philosopher. Now he has to backtrack off of that.
Well, I mean, because it's a contradiction. I mean, it's kind of a contradiction, you know, because a couple of people have asked me about this on certain blogs, and I go there and I say, it's going to be interesting watching this guy because how he's going to have to step away. Because Ayn Rand is fundamentally, she's an atheist, she's anti-Christian, you know. She hates any collective sort of mechanism like the federal government itself, like Social Security and Medicare. But she collected those. She took Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah.
So you have to wonder, you know. And then he's a Catholic. He's a Christian.
Yes.
So how does he square this stuff?
He has to kowtow. Well, he has to pretend this never happened. Romney and Ryan both have to kowtow on previously held long-time beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if this were articulated this way, they would have problems with the populace. But no one seems to be saying anything. They're able to say, "Well, I believe in this. Now I don't." It doesn't seem plausible. Anyway,
well,
Norman, listen, we got about a minute, so we're gonna have to close the shop. These shows are very quick. Any closing thoughts?
Well, it's going to be interesting and close. I would tell people the best way to figure out what the hell is going on is pay attention to the electoral guides. Go to the Huffington Post and look at their electoral college chart, and that will tell you which way the election is going. Right now, I think Obama has more electoral votes than Romney. So that's what you really have to look at. But, you know, things can change.
Okay, listen, Norman, as always, we appreciate you coming back once again. We might have to call you back.
I will say, Desmond, you are the first show that has actually did have me back on. Everybody else says that, but they haven't done it, and I appreciate the gesture.
Yes,
oh, no problem. We'll keep our word, and we'll keep in touch. We appreciate
it. Okay.
Thank
Norman
you.
Have a good night.
Again, folks. You too. Folks, that's been Afternoon Radio. We'll be back on Wednesday for our midweek review. We're going to go out on some hot music. This is Hot Music by Soho. See you on Wednesday.